Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest North Korean missile test that indicates their missiles now have a range to hit all of the continental United States and Australia. George Lopez, a professor emeritus of peace studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at Notre Dame University, who was on the United Nations panel of experts for monitoring and implementing UN sanctions on North Korea, joins us to discuss the extent to which Kim Jong-un has called Trump's fire and fury bluff, resulting in the president's limp response promising today to increase sanctions on the Kim regime, tweeting lamely that, quote, "this situation will be handled." We will examine the lack of military options and the need for a diplomatic initiative, and whether Trump, who is retweeting far-right anti-Muslim fake videos, reviving the Obama birther conspiracy, suggesting Joe Scarborough murdered his intern, and claiming that the Donald Trump captured on the Access Hollywood video was not him, has the competence or the stability to handle an increasingly dangerous situation that he has made worse. Then we'll get an analysis of the extremely unpopular so-called tax reform bill before the extremely unpopular Congress, which in spite of exploding the deficit, rewarding the already rich while shafting 99% of Americans, looks like it will pass and be signed by an extremely unpopular president. Dr. Jacob Hacker, a professor of political science at Yale University and an expert on the politics of U.S. health and social policy, and author with Paul Pearson of American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper, joins us to discuss how the Republicans are clearly more afraid of their donors than their voters and will empower the plutocracy even further, no matter how much it shreds our democracy. Then finally, we'll speak with Alexandra Ellerbeck, the North American coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, about the global implications of Trump's attacks on the press, who he has labeled as the enemy of the people and fake news. Not only is he putting foreign correspondents for CNN International and other outlets in greater jeopardy, but since Trump has taken his complaints about the press abroad and made common cause with leaders who are either murdering, jailing, or taking control of their press in Poland, China, Turkey, and the Philippines, he is contributing to the global retreat of democracy and empowering the spread of autocracy. And joining us now is George Lopez, a professor emeritus of peace studies in the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at Notre Dame University. He has served as vice president of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C., and also on the United Nations panel of experts for monitoring the implementation of UN sanctions on North Korea. His books include The Sanctions Decade, Assessing UN Strategies in the 1990s, and Putting Teeth in the Tiger, Improving the Effectiveness of Arms Embargoes. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Lopez.
Thanks for having me.
And this latest North Korean missile launch indicates, I believe a lot of experts agree, that the trajectory and the range would indicate that it could, their missiles with a nuclear warhead could reach all of U.S. Territory, mainland territory, and also Australia. So this is a game changer. But it sort of appears to sort of expose Trump's bluster here about fire and fury. He's been saying all these things, making all these threats, but he's been pretty weak in his response to this, which you could argue is the most provocative and conclusive of all of the threatening actions, indicating that they can actually deliver a nuclear warhead on Washington, D.C.
Well, at one level, I would completely agree with you. At the same time, I don't want anyone in this administration to hear any of us critiquing that your fire and fury wasn't strong enough and have them move ahead yet on the ladder of escalation. I'd like instead to argue that we've been operating under some incorrect assumptions about the North Koreans to start with, and we have not, despite what we're told is all the realism that pervades Washington now, and particularly the closest advisors to the president, we haven't been realistic in understanding what kind of foe we're dealing with. In particular, that neither sanctions nor any number of other measures were likely in and of themselves to dissuade this particular leadership in North Korea from getting to the point where they felt they could have a nuclear deterrent, which would do two things. One, it would prevent a preventive or preemptive attack by the United States. And secondly, it would make them a partner among equals at the bargaining table. Now, we may be yet far away from the bargaining table, but if Washington had accepted from the beginning of this administration, you can't denuclearize them through threats and sanctions. You can only do that through a bargained agreement in which they feel a sense of security. Then we would not be at the point of saying, well, how far does your bluster take you? Not very far. They're marching ahead anyway. If you would have understood they were going to march ahead to get to a particular point, and you set up your diplomacy in a way that could make the arrival of that point an opportunity rather than a crisis, we'd be in a different place.
Well, if we are threatening preemption, and that's always been the subtext, they're very vague about what they mean about other measures, and this not just Trump, but even military leaders who one would expect to be a little more sober, I have no idea what they're talking about in terms of what tactical means there might be to shut down a nuclear launch from North Korea. But surely just talking about preemption and, you know, by nature, a counterforce attack on North Korea's nuclear facilities, surely the North have thought about that, haven't they? I mean, I believe they
buried this. Certainly. And when you're dealing with a country elite and a military establishment in the North, all of whose training were to lead up to the day of the Great War, you probably have a very narrow time and set of actions you can take that doesn't feed into their preconceived notions of the actions that they'll have to take. You know, we say that there are three things that will always lead to war: dramatic changes in capabilities, dramatic changes in intentions, or dramatic changes in fear and uncertainty. Neither the U.S. nor, would I say, the North Koreans at this stage are going to change their capability. The intentions on the U.S. side to the North not being able to strike the mainland, and the intentions on North Korea that we not be able to strike North Korea, hasn't changed. The only variable we can affect with any significance is fear and uncertainty. And the kinds of scenarios that have been rolling out of different places in Washington, including some think tanks and others, talk about a surgical strike where, let us say, if that was your next action, you would today strike that very missile site that launched the missile yesterday, with the belief in Washington that that sends a limited but clear message to the North Koreans that the next attack will be more devastating. There's too many people I've met who believe that that would be a smart strategy, and they don't understand the minute the North Koreans detect that missile coming in, then the cannons start firing into the South, and 20,000 American troops and gosh knows how many South Koreans die. So again, we have out of Washington a series of statements about actions in search of a real strategy. The dilemma with the continued assertion by the administration that we're going to strangle them with sanctions is that sanctions have never been a tool which in and of itself can produce change. It needs a strategy behind it in which, after you enrage the target, you find a way to engage them, and engage them in a diplomatic and other ways that can reach part of the solution that sanctions are leveraging as the thorn in their side.
Well, but we've been on this fool's errand, believing that somehow the Chinese can get our irons out of the fire, haven't we? I mean, there's no love lost between the Chinese regime and the North Korean regime.
No, there isn't. And, you know, I've, in a couple of recent audiences, said on the basis of questions from average Americans, we of all people should understand what it means to be the key survival powerful entity to a power that's nuclearized but doesn't listen to you. Because what the Chinese are experiencing, and we seem to have too little empathy for, mirrors very much the U.S. relationship with Israel. The amount of military, economic aid, the amount of diplomatic cover we give them over the last 40 years still doesn't produce either serious bargaining at a peace table or the closing of settlements or a series of other things that some administrations have pressed the Israelis on. And we seem to believe that somehow the Chinese could accomplish with the North Koreans what we're unable to accomplish with one of our closest allies.
So how much, though, looking at the history of the nuclear age, and particularly the Cold War with the Soviet Union, my sense is that we were very lucky to survive nuclear war. It's bad enough to have one by on purpose, but to have one by accident is pretty unconscionable. And perceptions mean a lot. And, for example, in 1983, there was an almost a nuclear war over the Abel Archer NATO exercise.
Right, right.
And in retrospect, we've learned that the gerontocracy in the Kremlin took Ronald Reagan's words literally when he said they would end up on the ash heap of history. And when Cap Weinberger talked about nuclear decapitation, the leadership in the Kremlin took that quite personally. So I see a kind of connection there with what Trump has been saying to Kim Jong-un and now calling him a short, fat guy and rocket man, etc. I know, judging from what they did with the hack of the Sony pictures, how much the leadership is afraid of being lampooned, it would seem to me that that's kind of a little reckless, isn't it? I mean, do you think they are sober enough not to be provoked by that kind of reckless rhetoric from our side?
The truth is that none of us fully know, and that becomes a heightened dilemma as the days march on. It becomes one when in the United States State Department we have a skeleton crew on board to be able to assess how you might discuss with full cultural and past diplomatic language understanding what's going on in the Korean Peninsula, and particularly having enough kind of a deep bench in North Korean affairs to be able to present to the administration what might be the conflicting or set of perceptions that the Kim Jong-un regime is now thinking about. It again underscores the dilemma that we have no wider sophisticated policy that has multiple layers to involve strong allies in the region that can lend itself open to direct contact with the North, and certainly one that isn't imaginative enough to suggest certain unilateral or other measures that could be seen as de-escalatory. For example, I would think in the next week or two or three, the United States needs to make a decision as to whether or not we're going to conduct military exercises around the Korean Peninsula at exactly the time of the South Korean Olympics. There could be no smarter move in this time of escalation to suggest that we will forego those in the spirit of international cooperation and in the hope that we might find a way to bring greater peace and security to all peoples on the Korean Peninsula. There'd be no cost to U.S. ability to defend its own territory. There'd be no change in any of the war postures that we might have should North Korea have the ability at some time in the next 2 years to strike first. But it could have a remarkable change on the chessboard of diplomacy in which we're just not making any moves right now.
Well, we don't have an ambassador in South Korea, and we don't have a head of North Asia at the State Department.
Or on the National Security Council,
we don't have anybody, by the way.
Right. We do have, in the presence of Acting Secretary Thornton, a very capable person, but if the president doesn't want her to serve in that position of Undersecretary for Asian Affairs, then he had plenty of time to nominate her. You know, the first story in the U.S. news about that Victor Cha was going to be nominated by this administration as ambassador to South Korea appeared in late August. How is it possible that we're approaching the first week of December and the president had a significant trip to the region and he didn't have his ambassador to Seoul right next to him?
Well, is there, I know there's no finesse or subtlety or imagination in U.S. foreign policy. It's, in fact, a very alarming situation, so alarming that the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Bob Corker, has talked about the president's lacking competence and stability, which is a very loaded word.
Mm-hmm.
My sense is that you can't expect anything from these people except, you know, I talked to the former U.S. ambassador in South Korea, former CIA officer Don Gregg, and he's more afraid of Donald Trump than he is of Kim Jong-un. And that's pretty shocking. But just to go back to the Cold War analogy, the Cold War with Russia ended in large part not because of the number of missiles pointed at each other, but because of MTV and rock and roll and what's called soft power. Is there a soft power approach? Because my understanding with the Kim regime, I mean, when you think about the guy that just defected, the soldier who was shot up, and they found out that he had these parasites in his stomach, and and even those troops, which are the best fed in the North Korean army, were living on corn kernels. I mean, really pathetic. This is the tyranny of the weak. And we know that in North Korea, they turn off the electricity, which often turns off on its own anyway, to catch people and have video cassettes of South Korean soap operas jammed in the VCRs, and then they send them off to a gulag. So they're terribly afraid of the idea that this hermetically sealed hermit kingdom can be penetrated by the reality of the outside world. So my sense is that if you cooperate with them and you try to open them up with trade and reciprocity, then that's their Achilles heel. Eventually, the regime cannot maintain its psychological sway over the people.
And when you realize that once the United States makes that kind of policy possible, you have then dramatic increases in relationship between South and North Korea, as the new president there had hoped to build before this crisis hit and a change in U.S. administration changed the policy. You have the prospect for greater trade with China, the North on legitimate basis rather than smuggling, with Japan and the North and with the United States and the North. So it's not just a single opening we're talking about here. We're talking about a globalization dynamic, as you mentioned, of information, of goods, and of a view of the world that, yes, it may take 25 years, but 25 years of peaceful evolution, watching a kleptocracy collapse on its own weight, is certainly preferable to the kind of dramatic military exchange that even Secretary Mattis suggested last night might happen, or the way that Senator Graham in the United States said, if we have to fight a war, we will. This administration's policy should be that a war with North Korea is a dramatic failure in policy. But the problem is they haven't yet articulated to us what a realistic policy for de-escalation and putting this genie semi-back in the bottle can be.
Well, it's the height of hubris to suggest that you could have a war with North Korea at the expense of the South Koreans. They're our allies. They have skin in the game. Do they have a say in the matter, for God's sake?
Well, we know that that was a topic that was very much on the mind of the leadership in Seoul during the president's visit, but we have no real public discussion, no press releases to look at, in which there was a pledge that there would be a mutual decision before military action was taken. And I think that's something that the South desperately wanted. Maybe they received it, but were sworn to secrecy. We just don't know. The point continues to be, though, if the only policy options we're talking about is what, when, and how will be the character of the military strike, we have a bankrupt policy.
Well, it's, you know, I wish that I could have some sense that there's some competence in our government. I don't. I mean, we have a president who's retreating far-right fake news anti-Muslim videos, reviving Obama's birther conspiracy, claiming that Joe Scarborough killed an intern, and telling people that the Access Hollywood tape of him is a fake. This seems to be where his focus is. We're talking about a very, very serious situation that could ignite a nuclear holocaust.
Then it's incumbent upon people outside the office of the presidency, and including the media and those of us in policy research and education, to continue to put forth what the options might be. And there are a large, thankfully, cluster of bipartisan people at different think tanks in D.C. and elsewhere from the Plowshares Fund to the Arms Control Association to various other places that are saying, let's be realistic about what's happening. Recognize you can't demand that the North Koreans somehow reverse what is their policy of the last 50 years without there being direct engagement and a guarantee of a no first strike by the United States. And the longer that we in the press, academia, and policy push that and make that acceptable to the American people writ large, that's what it's going to take before people then decide that the president or the emperor has no clothes.
Well, George Lopez, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I'm very pleased to be with you. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with George Lopez, who's Professor Emeritus of Peace Studies in the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at Notre Dame University. He has served as Vice President of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C., and also on the United Nations Panel of Experts for Monitoring and Implementing UN Sanctions on North Korea. His books include The Sanctions Decade, Assessing UN Strategies in the 1990s, and Putting Teeth in the Tiger, Improving the Effectiveness of Arms Embargoes. We can take a brief station break and back with an analysis of the extremely unpopular so-called tax reform bill before the extremely unpopular Congress, which is likely to be signed by an extremely unpopular president.
It's not the end of the world. We could live it large, 'cause we're only old.
Oh, the grocer, though we have fun, tax collectors getting closer. Still we have fun. There's nothing surer. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Jacob Hacker, who's a professor of political science at Yale University, a resident fellow at the Institute for Social and Policy Studies, an expert on the politics of U.S. health and social policy. His latest books with Paul Pearson are Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, and American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Jacob.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Ian.
Well, it's just reading your bio there. It seems like the winner-take-all politics, how Washington made the rich richer and turned its back on the middle class, should be revived and updated. I mean, this is exactly what this so-called tax reform bill is all about, isn't it?
Well, and actually, Paul Pearson, my co-author, and I have written three books on contemporary American politics, and the first was called Off-Center, and it was about how Republicans had moved so dramatically to the right over the last generation. And so that trilogy of books began with our, I'm trying to choose the right word here, our puzzlement, I guess, about the GOP tax cuts of 2001, which were sort of the first example in the contemporary era of this kind of tax cut fever within the Republican Party. And those tax cuts were very skewed toward the wealthy, and they were very deceptively presented. We often told people that they were kind of like a subprime mortgage because, you know, they had this attractive veneer, but once you actually looked within the package, you saw that all of these tax cuts for the rich were designed to occur in the future. And it passed, of course, through a very partisan process in 2001. And in many ways, what we're seeing is a replay, but this time, you know, with everything magnified compared with 2001. I mean, this is a much more skewed tax cut for the rich. It is much more deceptively presented, and the gimmicks in the law are much more serious and stark, and that's partly because, of course, in 2001 we were talking about having a surplus, and now we don't have a surplus. We have huge deficits that Republicans are going to add to,
And it's also partly because Republicans feel as if they got burned in 2001, that because they had to phase out some of these tax cuts in 2010 and 11, that it gave President Obama the opportunity to end some of the tax cuts for the rich. And it's ironic, but Republicans really think that they lost back in 2001 because only two-thirds of the tax cuts were continued. And the reason they think they lost is because the one-third that didn't get continued under President Obama were the tax cuts for the wealthiest. So we are seeing a playing out, essentially, of the same script that we saw in 2001, yet this time it's, you know, what began as maybe a farce is a tragedy, right? And I agree completely with your basic take on it. This is a really winner-take-all politics, and it's really about abandoning the middle class to favor those at the very top.
Yeah, but there's a big chunk of historical amnesia in the retrospective that you just gave us. What about the 2008 crash? I mean, that's the part of it that I find so extraordinary, that we, you know, the global economy is brought to its knees, and there was this painful process of Obama bringing it back, and now it seems that Donald Trump is taking credit for an economy that was revived. I mean, it reminds me of what happened in the 30s with Roosevelt rescuing capitalism and then being vilified for it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the financial crisis is a huge part of the story. It's part of the reason why Republicans were able to capitalize on public discontent after President Obama's election and regain Congress and then most recently the White House. The financial crisis is also, of course, the backdrop for some of the financial regulatory policies and ultimately for the expiration of some of the Bush tax cuts that Republicans are now railing against. And you know, I think we now understand that Donald Trump's populism is as phony as his university was, and he is the strains of his campaign that have made it into governance are the huge tax cuts for the rich and the, you know, the effort to try to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, which recently failed, but which parts of which have come back in this tax cut bill. So, I mean, I think it's really important to understand how unusual what Republicans are trying to do is. This is far and away the least popular piece of tax legislation in the modern age. It's even less popular than some of the tax increases that were pursued by Presidents Reagan and Bush and Clinton to try to close the reduce the deficit in the 1980s and 1990s. It would seem shocking that you could run a $1.5 trillion deficit, which with a lot of gimmicks is what they say that the tax cuts will produce, that you could do that and yet produce a bill this unpopular. It seems like you're giving away $1.5 trillion. But the reason it's so unpopular is because the vast majority of Americans don't think that we should give a big tax cut to corporations and wealthy people, and that's almost entirely what this bill is about. It's certainly what all of the permanent parts of this bill are about. And, you know, I think we can say that the Republicans are on the verge of passing a bill that is almost universally disliked, even within their own party.
Well, but that's not to say that it's not going to pass. It doesn't. I mean, the pressure for it to pass is that they want, as Lindsey Graham said, our donors are telling us, if you don't pass this,
exactly. Don't
call us for money again.
That was Chris Collins in New York, too, said that. I mean, that's pretty striking because that's not like something that you would expect a politician to say, right? It means that if three or four politicians are willing to say it, it means that all of them are thinking it.
Right.
And yes, no, I said on the verge. Unfortunately, there are very, very positive signs for the Republicans with regard to passage of this legislation. They've managed to, it seems like, buy off or mollify many of those who are expressing skepticism, most notably the sort of positive signals being sent by Susan Collins of Maine, who, you know, was, along with John McCain, the sort of consistent opponent of, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, the most, you know, consistent opponent of the very extreme Republican health care effort earlier this year. So, And I think there are two reasons. So it's absolutely revealing, right? Not only that it's complete, that it's very unpopular, but that it's on the verge of passing nonetheless, because it suggests that Republicans are not only not responding to public opinion, but that they don't think that this is a catastrophic move for them. And I think politically, in earlier decades, doing something like this would have been a catastrophic move for a party. But I think they think that they've got enough donor support, enough insulation because of gerrymandering and the geographic distribution of voters, and enough insulation because of the degree to which they can throw up smoke and kind of, you know, hide what they're doing, or at least muddy the waters enough that they can squeak through. I'm not sure they're right about that, but I think it's very telling that they believe that.
Well, doesn't this then lead us back to Citizens United in the sense that we have a money-driven system, and if the donors are the ones that are being satisfied at the expense of the voters, the Republicans, if you watch the video of the protests before the Finance Committee vote, the people were being hauled out of there saying, kill the bill, shame, shame, shame. You could see on the faces of the Republicans the discomfort being confronted by their own citizens. Somewhere in their souls, I won't use any adjectives there, they must know that they're shafting the people that they represent and serving with total fealty the donors and the powerful in this country. And again, it feels to me like it gets back to that fateful Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, where the consequences seem to be clear to me that we've, as a result of this decision, we've embedded a plutocracy in America and shredded our democracy.
Well, there's no question that the role of donors and lobbyists is written all over this this legislation. I think it goes deeper than that. I think that what we've seen is the rise of a radicalized Republican Party that believes that it can pursue policies that are deeply unpopular because of the degree to which it will get support from these financial interests, and because it, in this age of negative partisanship where people are you know, against the other party as, at least as much as they are for their party, that they think that a lot of the base voters for the GOP are going to vote for them nonetheless. And let's just not underestimate the degree to which Republicans do have an edge because of the distribution of voters across districts and states. You know, the estimates are that they would need to lose the popular vote in the 2018 elections. You know, they'd need to lose the national vote for Congress by about 5 points, so 55 to 45 in favor of the Democrats, to actually lose the House. And the Senate still seems very secure, although the Roy Moore scandal has somewhat changed the calculus. So to me, you're absolutely right in terms of thinking about what's the fundamental driving force here. The fundamental driving force here is a party that has become more and more tied to sort of the contemporary plutocracy. But in thinking about why they believe they can get away with it, I think the many ways in which our political system is not doing a very good job of representing ordinary voters' preferences come back to this insulation that Republicans think they have against the kind of backlash that we would expect when a party pursues a policy with, you know, about 20% support. And again, this is the least popular piece of tax legislation in modern memory, and that's saying something, since a lot of the tax legislation in modern memory involved tax increases, not giving away $1.5 trillion.
Well, when you talk about insulation, though, it would seem to me that where the most profound and extraordinary insulation is happening in this country is in the extent to which Donald Trump still has this core support of between 30 and 40%. And my sense is that he's insulated by his phone pal, who he talks to almost every day, Rupert Murdoch, the head of Fox, because when you think about what this man is doing, you know, he's retweeting far-right fake news, anti-Muslim videos, which has appalled everybody, including the British Prime Minister. He's reviving Obama's birther conspiracy. He's claiming that Joe Scarborough killed an intern. And he's telling people that the Access Hollywood tape of him boasting about grabbing women's genitals is a fake. So this is what he's doing. And meanwhile, and I don't know whether you saw the picture of him sitting there with the empty chairs for Chuck and Nancy after he just insulted them and expected them to show up.
We all saw that picture. Well, I mean, a lot of people are playing into Trump's narrative, even you know, mainstream journalists who think they're independent are picking up on this. Yeah, no, look.
But this is not normal behavior. This is not normal behavior. I guarantee.
No, it is not. And it's also true that this, when we talk about this insulation, we just can't ignore the way in which the media bubble that in which you know, base GOP voters are now comfortably ensconced is really reducing the chance that you're going to get serious backlash, at least among those voters. That said, you know, it, as we saw in Virginia, which of course is a blue trending state, as we saw in Virginia, there is a lot of discontent, and those numbers, you know, the 30% to 40% support for Trump, those are not good numbers for a president. So the real question, I think, is, you know, to what extent, from an electoral and political perspective, is to what extent is this piece of legislation and the more general, you know, plutocratic push on the part of the GOP, is it going to really hurt them, hurt the party in the fall? I think if you look at why they chose to do what they did, you know, they basically have, and by the way, that means a lot of suburban Republican voters, right, are going to be crucial players in this, and those folks are getting pretty badly treated under the tax bill. So all of the kind of goodies that are in the tax bill go away in 2025 or six. I think it will depend exactly on what they choose. But the reason that they're doing the tax bill this way is that they have to fit it within this budget process. But even more so, in doing so and fitting in within this budget process, they're showing that their priority, their long-term priority, is to do the tax cuts for the rich, and that the middle-class tax cuts, such as they are very are cosmetic. So unfortunately, though, it's not clear to me that they'll be massively hurt in 2018 by this bill, simply because some of the middle-class tax cuts and the like that would affect these more suburban Republican voters will be delivered, and that it, but you know, I think this is the unpopularity of this bill is going to put to a test the Republicans' belief that they are insulated. But as you said, they have different constituencies they care about, and the one that seems to speak most loudly within the GOP right now is the donor class and the Koch brothers and the Chamber of Commerce and, you know, even the progressive precincts of the business community, like, you know, Apple and Google, that would just love to be able to repatriate a lot of the cash they're sitting on with low corporate tax rates.
Well, then, does this, just in conclusion here, does this mean, Jacob Hacker, that perhaps we're not looking at the right picture or the real picture, that we are distracted by Trump's daily whipsawing the attention of the press with bizarre behavior, and we're not looking at who's really reaping the rewards of this government? In other words, when you talk about chaos, as Jeb Bush did, there seems to be, in midst all the chaos, there seems to be some real winners so far. And you mentioned the Koch brothers a minute ago.
Yeah.
If you look at the only things that the House has gotten done, mostly through changing regulations, have been benefiting the Koch brothers. Offshore drilling, opening up Keystone, crippling the EPA. That's the Koch brothers' wish list. Now you add to that this tax bill, which is furthering the Koch brothers' wish list, getting rid of the estate tax, you know, which is going to destroy American philanthropy. There's no incentive now for the, you know, Rockefeller Fund, the Ford Foundation, etc., that have done so much good in this country. They just pass on all their money to their kids and consolidate an oligarchy. So are we not really watching the ball here?
we're not watching the ball. I mean, there are people watching the ball, but I think the healthcare debate was instructive, right? The reason I think in the end that Republicans failed, and they came awfully close on healthcare, and they're going to, as you know, they're reviving parts of the healthcare bill in the tax legislation. Notably, they're getting rid of the individual requirement to have coverage. But the reason that they failed was, I think in the end, that there was enough visibility in, of the effort and what it would do and enough pressure on them. And, of course, healthcare is different from tax cuts in that it involves imposing a lot of pain in the near term. And lots of people are going to lose their coverage, and lots of people were able to tell sympathetic stories about the ways in which they've been helped by the Affordable Care Act. So the reason they lost was because this did not happen in the dead of night. It did not, in the end, it was not possible for them to hide what they were doing. But this time around with the tax cut bill, it's abstruse, it's complicated, and there's so much stuff that's being thrown up. You know, all of these kind of cultural outrages and other, you know, Trumpian tweeting kinds of distractions are, you know, are making it hard, I think, for Americans to really see what's going on or to get mobilized around it. And the time is running out for that. And, you know, I don't want to be too pessimistic because I think there's a real chance that even if this bill passes, that it will prove to be a very significant albatross around the neck of Republicans in the future, and it should be, right? You shouldn't be able to pass stuff that people don't want and not pay a price for it. But I think we should recognize that this is a significant failure of democracy as we understand it, which is the idea that, you know, things should happen when they are broadly popular, that people shouldn't have influence simply because they have massive amounts of money, because this is really a bill by, of, and for the top 0.1%, not a bill that's by, of, and for the people.
Well, Dr. Jacob Hacker, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Ian.
And I've been speaking with Dr. Jacob Hacker, who's a professor of political science at Yale University and a resident fellow at the Institute for Social and Policy Studies and an expert on the politics of U.S. health and social policy. His latest books with Paul Pearson are Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, and American Amnesia, How the Warren Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Trump has taken his complaints about the press abroad and made common cause with leaders who are either murdering, jailing, or taking control of their press.
Reflects our democracy. Those crying voices on the right.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alexandra Ellerbeck, who's the Committee to Protect Journalists North American Program Coordinator. She previously worked at Freedom House and was a Fulbright Teaching Fellow at the State University of Pará in Brazil. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexandra Ellerbeck.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there's quite a lot to talk about, Alexandra, in terms of the press and press freedom, and particularly the assault on the press by Donald Trump by castigating CNN International the other day, suggesting that Fox News would be the better voice of America, if you will, abroad, and that CNN does a poor job of representing the United States, and accuse them of propagating fake news. But apparently, in his trips abroad, Donald Trump expresses solidarity with despotic rulers like the Polish government, like the murdering head of the government in the Philippines, and Erdogan in Turkey. He commiserates with them about the press and has common cause with these despotic leaders who have their own battles with the free press, and by the way, use Donald Trump's same phrase of fake news in defending themselves, if they do indeed, against critics for their brutality and oppression.
I think that's exactly right. You know, we've seen this moniker of fake news travel around the world. It's been used by the Syrian and Russian governments, by Chinese state media. The Cambodian President Hun Sen has actually referred to Trump directly in his battle with the media as justification for Cambodia's pretty extreme crackdown on the press in recent years. We saw Trump joking about journalists with Putin. And, you know, we have data that 58 journalists have been killed in Russia since 1992. So I do think it's certainly something that we're seeing spread around the world, and I think this rhetoric is such an extremely concerning example and gives a free pass for authoritarian leaders who are cracking down on their press at home.
Well, when you mentioned the Cambodian Hun Sen cracking down on the press, they're reporting the fact that he just outlawed the opposition, which is a pretty profound anti-democratic move. I mean, this is what it's all about, isn't it? That these people don't want anybody to report on what they're really doing. And that seems to be a sentiment shared with Donald Trump.
Yeah, you know, I think that authoritarian governments have always looked for hypocrisy in the West or in democratic countries as ways to justify crackdowns on the media or on critical outlets. But it's become much easier when the U.S. president is using phrases like enemy of the people to refer to the media. And I think that, you know, while media outlets in the U.S. have continue to have some of the strongest legal protections in the world and can sometimes brush off the occasional insult, I think the attack on CNN International was more concerning because many of its reporters are operating in countries where those protections don't necessarily exist.
And it's no small irony that Trump's attack on CNN International came on the same day that Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a new law requiring foreign news organizations in Russia to register as foreign agents. So normally, a normal American president would stand up and make a statement about that, being critical of Putin's moves. But Trump has some peculiar relationship, I don't know what it is, with Putin, but he's never criticized him. And that was pretty extraordinary. On the very day that he should be criticizing him, he was attacking CNN.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it shows that press freedom is really not a priority for this government. We did raise some concerns about the, you know, I think we foresaw that that might happen in Russia. We raised some concerns about the registration of RT and Sputnik under the U.S. Foreign Agent Registration Act, in part because it does help make it possible for the Russian government to have an excuse to retaliate in that fashion. But certainly the actions by the Russian government go farther in the restrictions placed on press that is forced to register and also on the type of media outlets that are being forced to register, including outlets that are independent and don't receive any government funding.
And again, I'm speaking with Alexandra Ellerbeck, who's the Committee to Protect Journalists North American Program Coordinator, who previously worked at Freedom House and was a Fulbright Teaching Fellow at the State University of Pará in Brazil. Well, already there's a great deal of concern, not just about undermining the security, if you will, of foreign correspondents abroad in authoritarian, totalitarian countries whose leaders are hostile to the press, and by sort of putting a target on their back, which Trump has appeared to have done. Here at home, two media organizations announced on Wednesday that they're suing the Trump administration. That's the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University and the Freedom of the Press Foundation. They're concerned that Attorney General Jeff Sessions back in August said that in terms of cracking down on leaks to the media, that the Justice Department is, quote, reviewing policies affecting media subpoenas. So what's going on the domestic front here in terms of protecting, you know, journalists, in particular, their First Amendment rights?
Yeah, I think that's a huge concern that we have. We saw the Espionage Act used to prosecute leakers really pick up under the Obama administration. The Obama administration started cracking down on leaks and actually used the Espionage Act to go after journalistic sources 3 times more than all the previous administrations combined. And I think what we have is that set a precedent where the Trump administration has a huge amount of latitude to use this 100-year-old World War I era law to crack down on sources that he doesn't like and to go after journalists who are talking with sources and maybe reporting on topics that are sensitive or uncomfortable for the administration. Now, there was a lot of pushback, actually, under Obama about his use of the Espionage Act and about the leak prosecutions that were going on and the subpoenas of reporters. And as part of that, the administration actually set in place more rigorous guidelines for when the government could subpoena reporters. They're not perfect, but they were seen as a huge step forward. And the fact that this administration, that Attorney General Jeff Sessions, is looking at taking a step back is extremely concerning. I mean, the idea that in the United States a journalist could go to jail for refusing to give up their source is crazy. And, you know, it sets a horrible precedent for the world.
But there's such strange things happening, though, in terms of not only is Donald Trump branding the legitimate media, or what is called often derisively the mainstream media, as fake news. And while his followers are sort of secure and insulated in the kind of Fox News, Breitbart, Sinclair bubble, where they basically are being told that the president tells the truth and the rest of the press lies, and that's an extraordinary fissure in this country, a divide that's almost unbreachable as far as I can tell. And that's disturbing enough in itself. But on top of that, it becomes more and more clear that the president has sources of information that come from the furthest fringes of reality, like mm-hmm. Alex Jones's InfoWars, and then the fact that he retweeted out this far right-wing obscure British group's fake videos of Muslims beating up a white kid and throwing him from a balcony out of a wheelchair. And you have the press secretary in the White House saying, well, the video may be fake, but the issues aren't about Muslims. So this is what I find extraordinary from the point of view of the freedom of the press and in terms of journalism is, where are the standards anymore?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly concerning, the fact that you can no longer tell whether something is true or not when it comes from the highest levels of government. I think that fake news is not a new problem, but I think it's certainly something that has been more concerning recently, and the fact that it is being used and given a larger platform by the president is deeply concerning.
Well, I know that, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post and others do report the news and the facts. And from your point of view with the Committee to Protect Journalists, I know you're more concerned about their physical protection, but does that extend to their sort of professional protection in the sense that this label of fake news is pretty pernicious? Mm-hmm. As we started out in this conversation, the despots and dictators around the world are using that term to their advantage to suppress any criticism of their brutality and kleptocracy. So how do we try to restore what is true and what is fake?
Well, I wish I had an easy answer for that, and I'm not sure that I do. I think that you just go back to the basics of journalism. It's transparency. It's showing your work, and it's consistency. And you know, I think that's what news media can do. And as press freedom groups, we can do everything we can to uphold their rights to do that job and to point out the pernicious effects of this rhetoric.
Well, I was particularly struck, Alexandra, by when Trump tweeted his attack on CNN International, labeling them fake news and suggesting that Fox News would be a better representative of America abroad. And the truth of the matter is that Fox has tried to make inroads abroad, and it hasn't worked because Fox looks like every other state media in every other totalitarian country. People, you know, they know what state media is like. And unfortunately, Fox News is becoming more and more like Pravda was during the Soviet Union. So to my mind, the response to Donald Trump's attacks on CNN International came from unusual sources, at least for many people, and that the people who came to CNN International's defense were the former head of the FBI, James Comey, who tweeted out a quote of Thomas Jefferson, suggesting that Jefferson had more faith in the press than he did have in government itself, and the former head of the CIA and the National Security Agency, General Hayden. He came out saying, you know, this is the most outrageous thing I've ever seen. It makes me feel like 40 years of my life haven't counted, in the sense that we're losing sight of what freedom of the press means. So how did that strike you? Because I know your organization and others have come to the defense of CNN International and the defense of journalists abroad being exposed to the kind of criticism that Donald Trump is leveling and that despots around the world he's showing common cause with. But how did the remarks by Hayden and the former heads of the CIA, NSA, and the FBI strike you?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, while we may have differences of opinion with the CIA, NSA, and FBI at times, especially when you get to issues of surveillance and other issues that affect journalists, I think I'm not really surprised that those individuals came out in support of press freedom, especially because press freedom has been a bipartisan value, and it's been a pretty widespread value throughout public institutions and civil society in the U.S. And I think one of the concerns we have now is whether that's shifting, and I think it's very important that it doesn't become a partisan issue, because if you look at you know, efforts to create a shield law for journalists, you know, current Vice President Mike Pence was actually on the Congressional Press Freedom Caucus and helped push forward a shield law. Its efforts for more transparency with FOIA have passed overwhelmingly with support on both sides of the aisle. So I actually think that that is not surprising to me, the sort of widespread backlash against Trump's statements about the press.
Well, Alexandra Ellerbeck, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alexandra Ellerbeck, who's a Committee to Protect Journalists North American Program Coordinator, who previously worked at Freedom House and was a Fulbright Teaching Fellow at the State University of Pará in Brazil. This is Beam Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.